The Oldie Recordings presents Adam Seizman on John Le Carré, The Biography. Brought to you by Doro, number one in the mobile market.
Hello, thank you. I'm here to speak about a biography I've written of John Le Carré, which came out a couple of months ago. And I've written several biographies before in the past. This biography presented different challenges, ones that I hadn't confronted before. The first, of course, is that my subject, I was writing about a living person. Now, this was both an advantage and a disadvantage. On the one hand, my subject was around for me to ask questions and generally get to know. On the other hand, his continued presence might be considered inhibiting. I'll return to that subject in a minute. The other issue in writing about John Le Carré is that, in a sense, he doesn't exist. He is, in a way, a fictional character. The name is a mask for somebody who's really called David Cornwall. To use an espionage expression, it's a cover name. And although his cover was blown a long time ago, it has helped him to keep the public at a distance. It's one of several means that he's used to conceal his tracks and to confuse those on his trail. His decision to use a pseudonym, given that he was working in intelligence at the time, is of course understandable. But the choice of the name John Le Carré remains mysterious. Over the years, he's given several explanations for this choice, and has always admitted that none of them are true. So what kind of person is David Cornwall? Let me quote to you what he has said about himself. "I'm a liar," he says, "born to lying, bred to it, trained to it by an industry that lies for a living, practiced in it as a novelist." He is his own creation, as perhaps all of us are to a certain extent, but he's particularly so. "People who have had very unhappy childhoods," he once wrote, "are pretty good at inventing themselves. And he's exceptionally good at this. As a boy, he learned to invent, making up stories to entertain, to tantalize, escaping from reality, and to dissemble, adopting one persona to conceal another. As a man, he put these skills to professional use, first as a spy and then as a writer. My task as a biographer has therefore been one of counter-espionage." Though famous, Le Carré remains enigmatic. He has perfected the art of hiding in full view, or as the Americans say, in plain sight. From the moment that he first appeared in print, it has been assumed that his stories draw on personal experience, as indeed some of them do, though not in the way that is generally understood. His books appear realistic, as if written by an insider. But in fact, much of the jargon that helps to give his books their sense of authenticity is his own creation. In an example of life imitating art, some of Le Carré's terminology has in fact been adopted by the intelligence services. Indeed, when a former head of the KGB was asked on whom he modeled himself, he answered, "George Smiley, of course." As Le Carré's career has progressed, details of his history have accumulated, though these are not always consistent. For years, he denied to interviewers that he'd ever been a spy, perhaps for understandable reasons. We all reinvent our pasts, he has written, but writers are in a class of their own. In the narrative of his life, fact and fiction have become intertwined. Untangling the two has not always been easy. I mentioned at the beginning the difficulty of writing about a living person. To write the life of a writer who's still alive, and indeed still writing, is a sensitive task. It involves complications that I'd scarcely needed to consider before. How could I write an effective, an objective biography with my subject looking over my shoulder? How could I win his confidence while remaining at a distance? I had to consider the feelings of his wife, his children, his brothers and sisters, as well as the feelings of my subject. My first contact with David Cornwell came in 2010 when I wrote to him proposing that I should write about him after finishing my biography of Hugh Trevor Roper. There are huge hindrances, he replied. My own messy private life, the demise of so many persons I worked with or otherwise knew, and my habitual reluctance to discuss my very limited and unspectacular career in intelligence. We subsequently met at his house in Hampstead. By this time, he'd read my Trevor Roper, and he decided that I was prima facie an appropriate person to write his biography. He made it clear that he wanted me to write without restraints, which indeed was the only basis on which I was willing to proceed. We came to an agreement by which he granted me access to his archives, a list of introductions to people he'd known, both friends and enemies, and interviews. I was to have a free hand to write what I wanted, provided that I gave due respect to the feelings of living third parties. I also agreed that he should have the opportunity to read the book first before anybody else read it. That's Jeremy, that's your phone, I think. I was going to say it's probably Le Carré, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well done, yes, yeah. I'm already going over my time, so am I not? No, 6 minutes. Okay. Well, I'll skip the next few paragraphs. that's very flattering. It would be disingenuous to suggest that there have been no difficulties between us while I've been writing the book over the last 4 years. I think our continuing relationship is an achievement in itself, David wrote to me in 2014. I can only imagine how hard it has been for him to have a comparative stranger explore every room in his life from attic to basement, to expose his mistakes and quarrels, and to probe his sore spots. There have been some tense moments between us, but there have also been a lot of laughs. I know it's supposed to be warts and all, he said to me at one point, but so far as I can gather, it's all warts and no all. It's been obvious to me at the outset that David, as he's become to me, has thought deeply about biography. One of my difficulties has been to keep up with him. All too often, he has anticipated my questions and formulated an answer before the question has even occurred to me. I've sometimes felt like a whaler in a skiff being towed by Leviathan. As I said at the outset, David has been reluctant to talk to me in detail about his time serving the intelligence services. He worked for both MI5 and MI6. On this subject, he has largely maintained the silence which he adopted when it was first revealed that he had done secret work. My account of this period in his life is therefore derived principally from other sources. Readers may share my frustration that he has not been more open in this regard when the enemy against which the Cold War was fought has ceased to exist. Even if one respects his loyalty to his former employers, one does not have to be excessively cynical to see that it served his purpose to keep this aspect of his life hidden. David Cornwell is known to be an excellent raconteur, and as is normal, his anecdotes have improved as they've been retold over the years. I've sometimes reflected that my unintended role has been to spoil a fund of good stories. He has, of course, explored his past in innumerable interviews that he's given since his first success. Reading these, one cannot help noticing how the answers that he gives do not always tally. One can see how it's sometimes been necessary for him to obfuscate, but at other times, this seems to arise from no more reason than a cultivated air of mystery. Everything he says, therefore, needs to be examined skeptically. For example, he's talked repeatedly about his refusal to meet Kim Philby when the opportunity arose during a visit to Moscow in 1987. By 2010, when he gave an interview to the Daily Telegraph, this decision had been elevated to one of the highest principle. "I couldn't possibly shake his hand," he told his interviewer. "It was drenched in blood. it would have been repulsive. But in fact, the diary of his travelling companion records David's as saying that he would dearly love to meet Philby, purely for zoological purposes, of course. Now, I don't think this is necessarily a paradox. Confronted with the opportunity to meet Philby, David recoiled from an encounter that he had been willing to contemplate in principle. Such discrepancies, if they are discrepancies, are not, in my opinion, examples of bad faith, but merely evidence that David, like all of us, edits his past as he revisits it, which he does more than most people. He has reimagined incidents in his past for his fiction, and when he remembers afterwards, it tends to be the fictional reimagining that he remembers rather than what actually occurred. Arthur Hopcraft, the scriptwriter for the television adaptation of David's autobiographical novel, A Perfect Spy, told me that when David talked about his father, he was not talking about his real father, Ronald Cornwall, but about his fictional recreation, Ricky Pym. Well, I think I have now gone over my limits. I'm just wind up and saying that I think of my biography as a work in progress. After all, my subject is still alive, and what is more, still writing. In fact, he's announced that a volume of his memoirs are due to appear later this year. He's threatened this anyway. From what I can gather, I don't think that these will cause me to rethink what I've written, but they may add some details here and there. And other new material has emerged as a result of the publication of my book. David himself has indicated that he will supply me with more information, including an account of his time in intelligence, though whether he really will do so remains to be seen. I plan, assuming that I live long enough, to issue a revised edition after David's death, to include some of the material that it seemed better not to include in his lifetime. But I'm in no hurry. Let's hope that there will be plenty more Le Carrés before that time comes. Thank you.
The Oldie Magazine Recordings. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for The Oldie 2015.